We've got Tony Gosling with us from England. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Hi, George. Thanks ever so much for having me on again.
Yeah,
oh,
welcome
boy,
back,
there's
Tony.
A lot. Yeah, Charlotte's in there with me, co-hosting.
I'm here, George. I can't hear Tony anymore, though.
What's that?
I cannot hear Tony anymore.
That's because I'm not saying anything at the moment, Charlotte.
Okay. Well, Tony, what's going on? Bring us up to date on the phone. I want to say hijacking, but that's not the word. The phone hacking scandal over there. Give us a little brief update on that first.
Sure. Well, you and I and Charlotte, we all know, and most of your listeners know, that official institutions like the FBI over there, and we have GCHQ over here, Government Communications Headquarters, which was really the modern-day version of Bletchley Park in the Second World War, which was listening into all the German communications and decoding them to at least enable our boys and the Russians to a certain extent and the Americans to steal a march on what the Nazis were up to in Europe. But, you know, we all know that this kind of stuff goes on amongst these intelligence agencies and to a certain extent the police. But what's been happening with hacking with the phone hacking scandal is this has basically been privatised. Glenn Mulcair, who's the private investigator who was hacking into phones for the News of the World, is all over the papers here today, really just saying, look, I don't want anyone to be under any illusions. I was being employed by News International. This wasn't not something that I did myself. Go to News International and offer my services. You know, basically I was working for them. They sent the orders of what they wanted hacking into along. I mean, you know, this is a massive scandal, and the big question is, you know, are the police going to actually arrest the right people? Are they going to do a proper investigation? Because the police are right in the frame as well. You know, the senior Scotland Yard detectives, the so-called untouchables. The word untouchables is not my expression. This is one used by Michael Gillard, who works now at the Sunday Times, which is ironically a Murdoch paper, and Laurie Flynn, who is a freelance investigative journalist who worked on some of the best TV investigations that the world has ever seen, I have to say, from the 1960s, 70s and 80s, a program called World in Action, which was broadcast by ITV back in those days. And they wrote a book. They were actually working for The Guardian in the Guardian Investigations Unit back in the late 90s. And they were doing some of the best investigations into Scotland Yard corruption. I mean, the close relationship between drug money and the senior police in Britain, that is the drug squad and the hierarchy of the Metropolitan Police. I mean, they point out, for example, that the most corrupt police in the country are always in the port areas, you know, over here. So that's places like Liverpool and London Harwich, maybe Glasgow too. That those are where that you find most corruption. And so that's what they looked into. The only trouble was the editor of The Guardian got a letter from Scotland Yard, really, you know, basically warning him off. And so there was a fallout between Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn and The Guardian, actually in 2001. And so they published their book called The Untouchables, Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard, which is a big, thick book. The only thing is that this book only did a print run of about 5,000, and then there was all sorts of problems with the publishers and certain questions about you know, the police actually wanting the book not to be published. And copies of that book are now going secondhand for about £350. I'm quite glad I've managed to get myself a copy.
And what is that book now? What's the title of that book?
It's called Untouchables, Dirty Cops.
The Untouchables. Does it talk about drugs? Is that what it's one of the core discussions in the book?
Well, what they're discussing really is just that the police in Scotland Yard, large numbers of them, Paul Condon, who was the police commissioner, said around about 250, are corrupt, institutionally corrupt, and they've got so much money, so much backing from the drug gangs, and that there is really nothing that can be done to get them rid of them, because they have the best barristers. They have also a kind of kudos that comes with the power that comes with this the drug gangs, and that they couldn't remove them. In fact, Duncan McLaughlin actually worked at the drug squad. He's another writer who decided that he might rather write than stay working for a corrupt police force. He wrote a book called The Filth, and in there he actually says that the Scotland Yard drug squad, when he was working in it, was actually the best organised criminal gang in the country. So you can see that this whole phone hacking thing is not necessarily going to be properly investigated by the Metropolitan Police because there is this
Tony, isn't there an axe murder that goes back a number of years and intertwined in all of this mystery and investigation?
Right. You're absolutely right, George. You're right on the ball with that one. And that is detailed in the book. And that was one of the stories that The Guardian actually told Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn that they weren't prepared to go there and they weren't prepared to print it, which is why the Guardian Investigations Unit basically fell apart in 2001 after pressure from the Metropolitan Police on the newspaper. The fact is, though, that a lot of the groundwork that was done back then is now actually seeing some bearing some fruit with some senior resignations. But I think, you know, there's actually
quite
a lot
of... We've got to take a break here and we'll be right back, Tony. Thank you for being with us. Man, it's enlightening. Appreciate you being with us. Be right back.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back, Tony Gosling.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome back, Tony.
Hi.
Yeah, so you're saying that there's a lot of more deeper things than a little phone hacking going on this deal, right?
Absolutely right. I mean, we've had a bit of a respite because Parliament is currently in recess, I think as soon as it gets back, and possibly even before that, you know, we're going to have more and more coming out about this. It really is basically a running sore, and that's because there is so much corruption being going on. It's now starting to come out. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but the Rupert Murdoch's press has done everything it can to divert attention from this. You know, it's even put a cartoon in one of the newspapers showing a little child out in Africa saying, "I'm hacked off with the phone crisis." You know, this is the idea being, obviously, that people would look at that and they say, oh, well, yes, this hacking crisis is not as important as the famine in Africa. Of course, you know, this is really, really low tactics. And as I said before, you know, they're using these phone hacking people in a similar way to what we were trying to hack into the Nazi German communications, you know, to be treated like the enemy. The other side of which hasn't maybe been explored so much with this is just what would Rupert Murdoch's papers look like without the hacking? I would hazard a guess, say here, that actually they'd be rubbish because nobody trusts Murdoch, nobody trusts his methods, nobody trusts his executives, very, very few people trust his journalists. And so the only way that Murdoch can actually get the stories is by stealing those stories. And this is what he's been doing with the complicity of Scotland Yard, the revolving door policy with loads of the News International employees actually cramming the public relations department. So if a journalist like me phones up Scotland Yard, I'm actually talking to someone who is an ex-News of the World employee in Scotland Yard, manning their press office, and the other way around, with a lot of former police then going to working basically as private detectives and even as a police informer. One example was one of the News of the World journalists was actually at the same time being paid as a police informer. Now, it should be obvious to everybody that you can't actually be working in the public interest whilst your paymaster is Scotland Yard. So it's just really a horrendous situation that's been able to develop there. So that's my take on all this. I mean, I think this is also, you know, in context with all of the horrendous stuff going on in other parts of the world, particularly Libya. We are starting to move towards a rather more nasty phase. It's becoming actually clear to me now that NATO is the most evil force in the world. I mean, they've been slowly but surely, particularly during this Libya campaign, just dismantling, smashing one by one all of the articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we all got around the table, around the world, and signed at the end of the Second World War. But that, unfortunately, on NATO's books, is an absolutely worthless piece of paper, and they've been tearing it up. I mean, smashing up their water supplies, all this kind of thing. This is absolutely outrageous. And I think we're starting to move towards the kind of dark days of World War II, which maybe wasn't totally inappropriate that I mentioned Bletchley Park and the old code breakers that did so much good work,
The Gladio stuff, wasn't that a NATO operation, intelligence operation?
Yeah, it certainly was.
And then that ties into this Oslo deal. Now, what's your take on Oslo? Give us some of your thoughts on Oslo.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's some interesting aspects to all that. First of all, the one of the first reports I saw, I think it was on ITN, it was reported there on the scene that said that he'd spoken to eyewitnesses who the guy hadn't shot, who said that the this Anders Breivik's name was called out by the police. And then he put his guns down. Now, this is very suspicious in my mind that, you know, that what is going on there? Usually somebody's arrested and then they're identified. Not they're identified first and then arrested. So they're clearly the police had some sort of prior knowledge. Maybe it wasn't the police. Maybe they were told who this was by the Norwegian Intelligence Service. And also, you know, the big question is, was he acting alone? That is the big, big question, especially since he's a Freemason. It's been clear now that he's a bold, you know, bold Freemason with his Masonic apron and sash, you know, looking like a Teutonic knight in the, on his Facebook page. But clearly, he does have secret contacts with other Masons in the lodge. So I would imagine
they sort of ran some kind of a new crusades against the Muslims at him. It sounds like looks like to me. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think,
you know, they sort of hustled him with some kind of crusades deal, and he's a great Knights Templar, and it's a rebirth of those Knights Templar to reorder this world against these radical leftists or something like that. That's sort of the hustle.
I think, to be honest with you, no ideology could justify what he did. Going to some extent,
no, of course not.
Caring people. And, I mean, I would actually put his actions in the league of the demonic. I mean, really, some kind of demonic possession, even, quite possible. How can somebody just in cold blood murder so many people, even one person, you know, but to then carry on and just kill and kill and kill? This is rather like, in a way, the Gladio operations. You're quite right to draw a parallel there, because this is, you know, the Gladio thing was all about special forces kind of turning up in the middle of a kind of relaxed, friendly, warm Market Street, and then just killing people, waiting for the police to turn up, for example, and then killing them too, not running away. So this is the sort of thing we see with Anders Breivik, is a kind of really you know, special forces trained guy right in the middle of you know, a normal you know. This is also paralleled, of course, right around the world, because we're seeing now increasing, I mean, I had a former soldier on my program in Bristol, which is at thisweek.org.uk, a few weeks ago, and he was saying that this is one of the things that he could not stand about the army, is that there was increasing numbers of civilian casualties. He was saying, we weren't fighting people who were really in any way equal to us. Yes, we were getting blown up by these roadside bombs and things, but you know, a lot of the people that they were killing were civilians, and you felt that this was absolutely out of order. This is a kind of paradigm shift from you know, okay, there were a lot of civilian deaths in World War II, but it's a paradigm shift from traditional warfare to see the Gladio style attacks, that is to say, you know, in supermarket massacres in Belgium, many bomb attacks and similar things in Blamed on the Red Brigade in Italy, and the beer keller bombing and other bombings by the so-called by the Meinhof, but actually carried out by the clandestine planning group, which is a part of NATO intelligence in Brussels. So, you know, this is rather worrying. But the reason I mention this, the Freemasonry thing, and this weird demonic aspect of this guy just wandering around as if it's a normal thing to do, just murdering everybody, assassinating everybody you see, because really they were assassinations. This is the political future of Norway that he was killing here. They're left-wing, basically left-wing people who feel strongly about a kind of socialist sort of attitude. And I'm aware that in the United States, socialist is seen as a bit of a dirty word, but essentially they're talking about a benevolent state that looks after its elderly people, that doesn't let them die in misery and poverty. And these were the people that he was murdering. So there's something really quite seriously evil. That's why I used the word demonic. And, you know, I think we're in the grip of a similar kind of thing. And he's just really one example, this guy, of something which we can see actually spreading across the Western world really in the last 30 or 40 years. Because I don't know about if you have contacts with former Freemasons, but one of the most important things that I've been told by former Masons is that we are actually in the grip of a big change in Freemasonry, which essentially in the Western world, in the US and Britain particularly, not necessarily in France, because that's Grand Orient Freemasonry, which is a different sort of thing, is changing from a kind of Christian character Freemasonry into a more satanic character of Freemasonry. That is to say, the lodges are being taken over by ruthless individuals who are then running those Masonic lodges in an evil fashion for power. Now, you know, we've been used to a sort of Christian, vaguely Christian, even nominally Christian Western world up until probably the 60s and the 70s when things changed a lot. So that's what I see, you know, as a massive change that's been going on. You know, your program's called The Secret Truth. I think this is one of the most important secret truths out there. Certainly, right. Talking to ex-Masons is the way that the character of Freemasonry has changed from Christian to satanic.
And NATO, right, Gladio Part 2 is underway.
Okay, we'll be right back, Tony. Thank you for being with us.
Charlotte Littlefield, welcome back. Tony Gosling, Bilderberg.org. Tony, you have been on to the NATO connection for years. There's information, interviews of you out on the internet that are nearly 5 years old where you've made the NATO connection to the Bilderberg group.
That's right.
The idea of the attendees list, have you gone over the Norway attendee list and contemplated that in regards to the NATO to the Norway massacres?
Actually, no, I haven't. But I mean, the thing is, the difficulty is here that all of the associations of Anders Breivik, I'm afraid, are going to be secret. They're going to be those which were through his Masonic lodges.
Well,
let's hope that the
Here's where my concern arrives. I'm familiar with this concept called by deception we shall do war, psychological operations, psyops. And my concern that he was paraded in his apron and all these portraits, and apparently this man was so egotistical, he had a nose job, a chin job, and he had plastic surgery. I mean, this is somebody who's been handled. And
yes,
his face has been changed for this grand event.
I would suggest his handlers are probably to be found rather close to these Masonic lodges too, though, because I mean the thing is that I think this is also.
Well, what about the intelligence agencies that did the Gladio? I mean, are we going to connect Gladio to secret societies and such?
Well,
Norway
did have a Gladio unit, and this is the kind of guy you would see in the Gladio unit, not necessarily a mastermind of it, because the whole thing was masterminded by SHAPE headquarters, Brussels, and NATO, and the MI6 and the CIA, and basically groups like the SAS were doing the training, and the Green Berets were actually physically doing these jobs. But, you know, I think that this guy, I wouldn't necessarily believe that this guy was it's probably handled by people, but he seems to me to be the sort of person who might be possibly trained up for one of these Gladio-style operations, certainly. I think it's very, very unlikely that he did this all on his own.
And Webster Turnbull,
this had to be run by NATO or one of their intelligence
agencies. It may be that he's just been sucking up propaganda that he's taken rather too seriously. It's really difficult. I think we've got to be quite careful not to prejudge things without actually getting the evidence. This is what the Murdoch Crown did when it came out with Al Qaeda headlines last weekend. All day Saturday, incredibly, even the day after these attacks, they were still saying it was a Muslim Libyan attack, this kind of nonsense.
Yeah, but it wasn't just a lone wolf operation, let's face it. It was too complicated. And also, for him to reach a psychological state to do what he did would have had to been a conditioning that occurred over years.
Drugging.
That's what I think. He wouldn't just think this up over a few months to go out there and build a bomb and start killing people. It's a psychological buildup on him, a Manchurian candidate type of techniques that they did with him.
What
this is all about, it looks like to me, is to create in the Norwegians' mind, the average citizen, that warrants a closer surveillance of each and every Norwegian citizen, a bigger police state, a more scrutiny of web, a closer, you know, scrutinizing and a more intrusive effort into each one of the Norwegian citizens' lives. That's what I see.
Yeah, but I mean, certainly it could be this NATO-style intelligence agency behind it, and also these kind of dark, spiritually dark forces as well. But I think, you know, it's important to remind everybody that actually there is a very positive, the most positive and fantastic intelligence agency in the world is, what do you think? Because I think it's God. I think it's God.
Is that a trick question?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay.
God inspires decent people around the world to do all sorts of acts in a kind of weirdly coordinated fashion, even though they have no idea that they're being coordinated. This is exactly how God works. And I think that, actually, this is also the kind of thing that NATO is trying to sort of substitute and emulate, this kind of thing. But, of course, it can't. It never will. It will try, and it will go down trying. Ultimately, you know, the dark forces are going down. I've no doubt about that. But they will go down with a big, big fight, and they won't like it. But ultimately, you know, I think this is just certainly, I don't know what your religious views are or anything, but I see that there's a much greater force at work than certainly than the Gladio people and NATO. And there's actually a positive side to all this in that there are people doing really good stuff around the world. They don't get quite so much publicity than does Breivik does.
Right. Let me ask you this, Tony. How do you think this ties in with the money problem? The way the Bilderberg Group is royalty, banking cartels, the whole fraternity of corporatist elite, worldwide royalty. What about the money? How do you think this might impact the money thing? It was my understanding that Norway had just pulled out, they were being forced to back Greece by 50%, even though they're not a part of the EU. And they had just put their foot down.
There was a partnership deal that they pulled out on because Greece couldn't come up with their 50% on their partnership.
Another very, very important thing, of course, is pulling out of, because they are part of NATO, they're pulling out of Libya, I think it's tomorrow or the day after.
Yeah, right, August 1st.
Exactly how the Gladio operations worked. For example, in the Brabant massacres in Belgium, the supermarket massacres, that happened just at the time that the Belgian government were voting whether or not to allow the cruise missiles, the U.S. ballistic missile system, into Belgium. You know, this, it does make you wonder whether this is just a sort of shot across the bows to the Norwegian government saying, well, look, you're in NATO, so you better be part of Libya or else.
Get back in line, you know. You know, there is a bit of history here that's interesting. The Oslo Accords were formulated and put together in Oslo. And they finished them on the 20th of August, 1993, and they were eventually signed at a signing ceremony in Washington, D.C. by Yasser Arafat and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and President Bill Clinton. And so the Norwegians were a very moderating force between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and it looks like that they've taken more of a hard line against the Israelis, favoring the Palestinian side in the last few years.
Now, I think it's also true that there was a lot of resistance against Nazi occupation in Norway, and the memory of that has not entirely gone. You've got quite independent-minded people up in Norway that look at the rest of the world down below them in a weird way, you know, looking down the map at the rest of the world from a slight distance. They're rather happy that they're not all tied in with the corrupt European Union and with the part of NATO. But, you see, the thing is that they can actually act for the good as part of NATO. It may be that this is the sort of conversations that's had quietly around these military tables in Brussels is that the Norwegians have been quite a moderating force. In fact, I think that's absolutely, you know, very, very likely that they have been leading in some ways the criticism of the hawks on Libya. So, you know, this is, I think, definitely very likely to be a part of all that.
Well, yeah, I think that's critical. Pulling out on Libya is a thing that they're totally against. NATO was totally, and everyone was critical of Norway on that.
Yeah, but the bigger picture, of course, is this kind of strangulation. I mean, I look upon it as a sort of the tree of life, you know, is all things good and wonderful, and we've got this kind of ivy growing up around it and starting to strangle it. You know, I talked earlier on about the 1960s and 70s, and I think, you know, if you look at some of the TV series, the films, the kind of culture that was burgeoning back in those days, what you see now is a kind of counterfeit version of it. It's almost like the ivy is strangling it. It's wanting to use the light from those older ideas, and they basically take a lot of those ideas. You know, you see so many remakes of films. What they try and do, it seems, is to get the core of something which was fantastic and honest and be creative, and then turn it into something rather weird and something which backs their...
Yeah, they skew it off to... Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
I noticed that.
I don't ever really bother watching any films, apart from possibly Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, since about 2000, and then also possibly the Lord of the Rings films, which we talked about last time. I've got my own theories about the Illuminati symbolism in the Lord of the Rings and J.R.R. Tolkien and his research he was doing at Oxford in the 1940s.
We could talk about that, Tony, on the other side of this break I hear coming. Lord of the Rings, hey, I think there's a great parallel with that Oxford writer.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth on the second hour. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield, and a warm welcome back to our guest, Tony Gosling, Bilderberg.org. Welcome back, Tony.
Hi, guys, from Stroud, rather dark, I must say, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning here, in Gloucestershire, which was actually the heart of the Industrial Revolution. This is where it kind of started, actually, in Britain. But you know, we were talking a bit about the Tolkien, weren't we? And I mean, you know, I think it's really exactly what the dark forces are in our world today. You know, and I think Tolkien does quite a lot to help.
Well, a little history on him. Before he exited his what you would consider, I guess, secondary school, and before college, he actually started his own secret society. Semi-secret society of pals. They were writing poetry. So he was obviously aware at a young age of the secret society influence in his world. Of course, he went on to do service in the military, became ill, did all sorts of different adventures. But one of his first big jobs after World War I was at the Oxford English Dictionary, where he worked on history and etymology of Germanic words beginning with the letter W. And when he got on with Oxford, he was a professor he returned to Oxford as Rowlandson and Bosworth Professor of Anglo-Saxon with a fellowship at Pembroke College. But please, I have an idea about this. And please, what do you think he's revealed in his writings? I'd love to hear what you have to think.
Isn't it interesting that he was into Anglo-Saxon and Old English? Because, really one of the biggest problems we ever had here in England before we ever did our dirty work, and others did, obviously, over in creating the rather weird system that you got in the United States, it was the Norman invasion. And, the Normans, when they came over, of course, the Normans were, this is around about, it was 1066 when they invaded. But it brought with it a very sort of fake Christian system. And this just goes right back to what I was saying about the tree of life and the strangling ivy around it. Because what they did, the Normans, is that they had this kind of nominally Christian thing. But what they did is they just got rid of many of the most important Christian laws, such as the law of usury. That was the first chink in the armor of the usury laws, was when the Normans took over. Because they were actually Vikings who'd been living in Normandy in France. So that was, you know, that was one of the most important ever changes in the law in Britain, to get rid of to give moneylenders the right to charge interest, was brought in by the Normans. But what Tolkien was putting together, I think, you know, and I did say this last time, but it's basically the white hand of Saruman, who's the white hand being symbolizing Freemasonry, and the eye of Sauron symbolizing the Illuminati. So there's a sort of strata of, first of all, individuals on planet Earth get into Freemasonry, but then they're sucked up into this hierarchy, into the Illuminati, because they've got this constant wish to progress up through the system. And they're slowly conned in masonry. One way or another, they're told that, you know, this is going to be great if they get one more step up the ladder. But as soon as they get up into these illuminated masonry, what they're doing then is they're actually getting into really dark stuff. And John Robison, as you may know, who was the Secretary of the Royal Society in Edinburgh in the late 1700s, did a very important book translating a lot of leaks that had come out of Bavaria and Germany and from France too, as part of the French Revolution, into English. And that book is called The Proofs of the Conspiracy. If anybody is interested in the dark forces, they've got to have a copy of this book, which you can get off sacredtexts.com.
Yeah, I read that. That's an excellent book. He revealed the Illuminati takeover of Freemasonry in 1782.
That's right.
And
Wilhelm Bond, there
was a big
conference
there.
Tony, repeat that for our listeners, please, so they've got that book clear.
Targeting.
I'm sorry, Tony, can you repeat the name of that book so the listeners are sure to have it clear?
It's called The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe. And it was 1793 by John Robison, R-O-B-I-S-O-N. Now, he was also a close personal friend of James Watt, who was the inventor of the steam engine. And Robison himself invented, he was a bit of an inventor. He was a secretary of the Royal Society. He'd have to be. And he invented the siren. So throughout World War II, you know, when the sirens were going off, everyone was, well, they maybe didn't realize, but this was Robison. In a way, he himself was a giant siren through history, ringing out, saying, well, hang on, guys, watch out for these Illuminati, because they're planning trouble for the future. And you know, obviously, things like Robert Anton Wilson, he wrote a lot about it, and a lot of that is sort of clutter and claptrap designed to sort of make a joke of the whole thing. But the Proofs of a Conspiracy really does pin it down to the fact that they're targeting the media, they're targeting religions, all the major religions, and also targeting government. So if you want to, and the military, so if you want to understand what the dark forces are targeting, you've got to get hold of a copy of Proofs of the Conspiracy.
Well,
a lot of work.
John Robison sent that book to George Washington. Did you know that?
It wouldn't surprise me at all. But then George Washington.
But I don't think Washington ever read it, though. That's what the story goes.
Well, there were a lot of Freemasons who felt that to read that kind of thing, to think those kind of thoughts, that maybe that they wouldn't be in favor, found favor. So, you know, that's, I think, you know, in a way, it was an appeal to Freemasons, that book, you know, because it's really bemoaning the destruction of Freemasonry. And as people in, as I was saying, the last few decades, who were saying exactly the same thing, the craft is not what it was. And that's because it's been thoroughly infiltrated.
Yeah, that's what he was warning about, the Illuminati takeover of what existed at the time called Freemasonry.
Yeah, and what
it's a good book. It's a good book.
And what one of the things that I've seen recently, I don't know if you guys have come across this, is that the total, when they set up the United States, it was done with a very specific occult purpose, in that the total number of the officials in the U.S. government, that includes the Supreme Court, the congressmen, the senators, all the White House major officials, people like the president, the vice president, secretary of state, if you total them all up, and maybe, you know, your listeners can do this at home, it comes to the number 666. And this was because, you know, the way that the Washington Street Plan was laid out, and also the way the government was set up, was a really, you know, the idea was to hide in it all these kind of occult figures. Now, I don't think that Tolkien went into all this kind of thing, but one of the things he did go into, everybody, you know, that studies Tolkien will finally eventually come to this, is that he was digging into some of the very first translations into English of Pseudepigrapha, which is this kind of Old Testament apocrypha, so books like the Book of Enoch, this kind of thing. So he was fascinated by, not only by old Anglo-Saxon English, but he was also fascinated by some of the stuff that was coming to light in the 1920s and 30s for the very first time, and reading this eschatological literature from Old Testament times and incorporating it into his plan, really, for the Lord of the Rings. So I think there was a lot more to that, you know, than meets the eye. And he was quite right to be secretive, in a weird way, about the way he was putting it together. Because, you know, for even a lot of people who are into the occult, you know, people who are into witchcraft, they wouldn't necessarily see what he was doing. But we can certainly watch the films and enjoy them now, and maybe pick out some of the symbols and then smile at his rather erudite way that he put those books together.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating
okay.
stuff there when it comes to J.R.R. Tolkien. I share his birthday, by the way. Only a different year, obviously. He died
okay.
5 years after I was born.
We'll be right back, Tony. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, we were talking about Tolkien again, weren't we? A lot of the conversation seems to have revolved around him. And also, he had a little group called the Inklings, you may know about. He was very friendly with, this is while he's at Oxford, and I lived in Oxford for 4 or 5 years, and you keep coming across these, like, plaques. Well, there's one beautiful one in Magdalene College Garden, and, you know, if any of your listeners ever visit Oxford, you've really got to visit Magdalene College, because you go in through the gates in the high street in Oxford, and you walk into these fields, and to be really honest, you feel like you're right out in the middle of the countryside, even though you're right in the middle of a city. It's beautiful gardens that they've got in there, and there is actually a plaque to C.S. Lewis in there. One of the most fascinating books that C.S. Lewis ever wrote was to do with the infiltration of a university. It's called That Hideous Strength. And it's all about how a kind of quite friendly group come to really sort of appear into the university where this chap's working as a professor in his book. And what they're actually doing is they're a bunch of real weirdo occultists, but they have this very, very slimy way of appearing to be nice, and we're here to do good and this kind of thing. Absolutely fantastic stuff. And they were all very much aware of the sort of, I think, hidden power that had been going on during World War II. They weren't just thinking about, these big struggles that we've had over the centuries between good and evil, but they were thinking of how to put that, I suppose, into an everyday concept. I mean, C.S. Lewis was particularly good at that. But with the Lord of the Rings, you know, Tolkien did a fantastic job, I think, in putting the whole apocalypse that we will be facing at some point in the future into these kind of filmic epic terms. And, I have really no idea how far away that is, but, it certainly seems to be edging closer. Now we're in this kind of nuclear standoff the Iranians. This is all starting to move a little bit rather too close, what with the Israelis armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, but in serious denial about, being part of the world community and making any kind of agreements over what to do with nuclear weapons. So, it's really rather an edgy situation that we're in these days. I think you guys would probably agree.
Yes. Can you hear me, Tony?
Yeah, I can hear you, yeah.
Okay, I was going to ask you about the J.R. Tolkien thing about, one ring to rule them all. I think each ring were various groups, secret societies and such, or royalty, or banks.
Well, certainly with royalty. I mean, I actually, it's funny because we had a little sort of tiff last time, Charlotte, over democracy and, that kind of thing. I actually think that royalty is a better way to do things ultimately, but the thing is, our royalty in this country, that is to say, if you get a decent ruler, then there can be an empathy between the ruler and the people. With a democracy, it seems just like a sort of corporate system where the most ruthless person gets put in charge often. But anyhow, we've got a system here in Britain for the last 500-600 years of the monarch being totally surrounded by this weird organization called the Order of the Garter. Based at Windsor Castle, supposedly, and there's 26 members of the Order of the Garter, which, of course, is 2 times 13, which is 2 covens. And so the suspicion has to be, is this some kind of witchcraft, Masonic witchcraft system?
So, King Harold's a member of that, of Norway.
He's a member of the Order
of the Garter. Yeah, he's a member of the Garter. He's tied right into British Norway as the top king and everybody, power structure. That's why they're all Freemasons over there in Norway, Norway.
That's right. There's a lot of Freemasonry around. But
it's all in there. There's 60, there must be about 90 or 100 lodges in Norway. I checked it out. And King Harald is a member of the Garter, Knights of the Garter.
That is nothing compared to the number of lodges in America and Britain. So I think...
Norway's a smaller... it's 4.5... 4.8 million people. It's not a very large country to have those kind of lodges.
Yeah, I think that...
They dominate. What they've done is the synergist, if you know what that word is, Tony, synergy. Not synergy, but synarchy, okay? That's the rule of a government or the dominance of a government through the secret societies. On a very, you know, behind the curtains type of arrangement, see. That's what they've done, whether it's Norway or England or United States. The secret societies are ruling behind the curtain on all these major.
The question is, I mean, where is this going to go? I mean, and how exactly is it going to unfold? I mean, that seems to be the most important question to me. And there's a couple of people who've done a lot of really important work on that. One of them, I don't know if you've ever spoken to him on your show, but he's the author of The Antichrist and A Cup of Tea, a guy called Tim Cohen, who's a Messianic Jew. Have you come across him?
We haven't interviewed him. I got an itching question I have to ask you about. I was researching the origins of Christianity, and I came to find out that there was a great debate. If you really dig into the authenticity of, a lot of people think just because it was an ancient scripture that it meant it was a good scripture. But it turns out there's been this ancient battle between two groups of sort of one's actual, disciples of Jesus, if you will, and then the ones, like you said, the Vikings came through and implemented a sort of polluted form of Christianity. And the essence of this battle, this doctrinal battle that goes way back to the beginning of, A.D. or the time of Christ or whatever, is that within these circles of themselves, they're promoting a type of Christianity that ends up with the person being sovereign and being Christ-like, and denying the divinity of Christ.
There are all sorts of really dangerous, I think there's all sorts of really dangerous versions of Christianity, one of which is this whole thing to do with the rapture, where people are promised that, as Christians they will be whisked up into the sky and they won't have to suffer at all. This is actually, I think there's extreme danger in putting these kinds of interpretations on the Bible where it's really not clear in the Bible that that's what it's saying at all. So the idea really being to sort of make people feel that they're some kind of elite club when they become a Christian. I find Christians around me sometimes saying, oh, hey, have you been saved? And I feel like saying to them, well, how do you know you have, Sonny boy, And there's this kind of elitism that goes with this, in with this kind of fake Christianity. But one of the people I think who's been brilliant in interpreting the Bible for people who are looking into the future is this New Zealand pastor called Barry Smith. I mean, he died 5-6 years ago, but he did several films. He used to go talking around, he was from New Zealand, around that part of the world. He did a very good video called The Global Church. He was talking about a kind of new age, fake multi-faith religion that was coming along. But he pinned everything he said down verse by verse to the Bible. He did an incredible job on that.
If you haven't come across Barry,
they should really track him down. He's the person that came up with this, adding all of the U.S. government together and coming up with a number of 666.
Okay, Charlotte's going to be reconnected here in a second. Anyway, Tony Gosling is one of the most interesting guests that we've ever had. He's very, very knowledgeable about the Bilderberg meetings that have taken place over the years, and he has an excellent site, on the web and so forth. And I want you to go in there and look his site up. Scroll down on The Secret Truth, our homepage here, and go in there and look at his site. Just go in there, and it has his site next to his name. If you click on it, you can go in there and pick it up. And he has a site that is very, very deep. Well, let me put it this way. The name of the site is www.bilderberg.org. Again, that's www.bilderberg.org. Anyway, go in there and start looking and perusing his site. He's got a wealth of information. He's been at this for a relatively short period of time, but he's gained a tremendous amount of experience and information. Okay, welcome back, Charlotte.
5 years old. I mean, he may not have been in this 30 years, but he certainly has been studying it in depth.
Yeah, Tony. Tony has on the click off there where it says index. Go in there to that site and click on index, and he has a plethora of differing things one after another. You know, where you can click on and go out and get information very quickly. So he's very, very well educated, and he was with BBC for a number of years on differing kinds of community programs and so forth. I should have let him introduce himself and tell our listening audience, you know, about his background.
We have his bio. We have his bio posted.
At this time. Yeah,
we
but
do
anyway,
have his bio posted.
He's very astute, and he has a grasp, a very deep grasp, like John Robinson, you know what I mean? The book was written in the late, you know, 1700s, you know. In fact, I think
right.
The name of the book is something like that, Proofs of Conspiracy, 1798, or something like that. You
well,
know,
actually,
and then
I looked
a
it up
and,
I'm
going to, that, you know.
I looked it up. I'm going to add it to my, my library. It's called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe Carried on in the Secret Meetings of Freemasons, Illuminati and Reading Societies. Author John Robinson. So it's pretty
R-O-B-I-S-O-N, yeah. Robinson,
and
yeah.
And you get it used on Amazon for about $12. So about $10. But at any rate, for a book that was printed so long ago, it's still in print. So it's
holding some
weight.
What's interesting about the book is that he's a Freemason. He was a Freemason out of the University of Edinburgh. Scotland, and he's a well thought of Royal Society member, all that, well ensconced in the Royal Society and the scientific group there, and he was recruited by the Illuminati to go into the Illuminati system on mainland, the European mainland, and they wind and dined him, did a bunch of love bombing on him and stuff, but he saw through all of that and came back and wrote the book and to warn not only his fellow Masons, but the world at large about this thing called the Illuminati. And before that, 1782, there was a meeting in Wilhelmsbad, which pretty well had the Rothschilds involved in there and the Hessians that fought us in the American Revolution. It was the same people were up against steel. They haven't gotten, away. They've gotten bigger, haven't they, huh?
Yeah, you know, Georgia, I was trying to bring a point up, studying I've been doing, and I'd like to direct our listening audience to my point that I was trying to talk to Tony about, and I'm going to email him this link, but it's called Total Onslaught, 213B, Battle of the Bibles, and it's a historical look, it's from a preacher's perspective, of course, about the authenticity of the genuine Christianity, if you will. We're talking pre-Vatican. We're talking where did the Vatican get its who started the Vatican? What was the Christ-inspired?
That's a good insight into the founding of the Catholic Church. It's quite a story alone.
Multiple biblical sources, George. Someone said, "Well, I saw it in the Bible." Well, there's so many different Bibles in circulation, it's fair to say it.
The word Despazini seems to ring a bell with me, and the Despazini is a word to describe the Christ family, Jesus' close family. And the Despazini are very little written about. And so you do have some early churches that claim to be the original, you know, Christian churches from Jesus' preachings and his teachings, but they faded, and these bigger, churches like the Catholic Church and others took over. They really took over.
Yeah, Constantine saw it as a mechanism of control.
Yeah. But I will say this about, you know, Christianity in general, and especially about Christianity in this country, or organized religion, or however you wanted to describe it. Well, the safety nets and the services and the goodness that they're still producing is really, if we didn't have something called religion in this country, I'd be very fearful of what would happen. I mean, it'd be in total chaos, looks like to me. So they have been out there working. There's a lot of good people
that
go to church, and do a lot of good things for the country.
I don't believe in original sin. I think our morality comes from our humanity.
What it is, Charlotte, though, is that there's people that adhere to the Ten Commandments and things like that, and that's a good, decent way to live. There's nothing wrong with those kind of rules.
Yeah, and those predate the Bible.
People have spent lifetimes in these little Baptist churches and led very clean, good lives and raised families and done a lot of good things for people and other, not just the Baptist, but other churches too.
George, let's face the fact that the Ten Commandments predate the Christian Bible. They're still a creation of man. I mean, it's something, somebody had a good idea and they wrote it down.
The New Testament is what I focus in on. It's about forgiveness. And there's no other teaching or philosophy that has the concentration that the New Testament has about forgiveness.
I couldn't agree more. I think forgiveness is the key.
So you know what I mean? If we could just go, and I've said this before on the program, if you walked into a church and your minister just had a big sign, you go down there Sunday or Saturday or whatever, and he held up and all it had printed on there was forgive, and you turned around and saw that and left, there would be more goodness done in the country than anything else probably.
In the man's of Easter.
They get these theology schools and they intellectualize it and they ruin the word. They over study it. You know what I mean? They just, if you take the written word, either the Old or the New Testament, in plain written form, and don't try to read too much into it, you're going to get a lot out of it. And there's a lot of wisdom and goodness there. And in my opinion, the New Testament, is the Old Testament, eye for an eye, and the New Testament is forgiveness, basically, the way I see it.
Yeah, the whole different change in theology, frankly. It's a big, huge change. So anyway, that's a discussion for another day.
We've got that thing in Oslo that was a terrible thing. We did write that deal. What is it called? Security Detection Unit. They've had those since about 2000 in our embassies throughout the world. Not in every embassy, but quite a few. And they did have a pretty large one in Oslo. It was located outside the embassy. They cannot locate these security detection units inside the grounds of the embassy. Because the embassy actually is like part of our state. You know what I mean? It's considered owned property, of the United States government, basically. And when you go into an embassy, someone else's embassy, you're actually trespassing onto their property and to their, not sacred ground, but it's a legality. But anyway, they were operating the security detection unit down the street from the embassy in Oslo on the third floor of a building there. And they had about 15 employees, and they were employing former policemen and security and intelligence people from Norway. Yeah.
Very important. Most people don't know about that, George.
Anyway. Okay, is that the music coming on there?
Yes, it is. Break time.
Okay, we'll take a break and come back and finish up the last segment. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Anyway, George, let's talk about the Norway attendees that you wrote about, in that article. Do you find it suspicious that there were no Labor Party attendees?
There were what now? Say that again.
Did you give any thought to the list of Norway leadership that attended the 2011 Bilderberg?
Yes, I have. Some of the list got the Russian wrong. They were calling him Swedish, but so I corrected that in my own mind. But the Crown Prince was there. Whether or not the Prime Minister was there, Stoltenberg, I'm not sure. I'm not positive on that. Our article may not be correct in that respect. Okay.
Yeah, the list, I wanted to also say that I wanted to put a disclaimer on the list, purported attendees, because there is a list that is now released that may or may not be accurate. We don't know.
The Prime Minister is the only person in our list that there's a question about, because on the Bilderberg meeting, they don't always give out all the people that attend. See what I mean? They don't disclose always, like Bill Gates was there and Robert Gates was there in St. Moritz. They did not have that on their official list that the Bilderberg group put out too, see. Well, now, way back to the original group, there's a socialist, founder of the Socialist Party there that we had, and she was there definitely. And also, she did not grant immunity. There was a request for immunity. You remember the guy that blew the whistle on the Israeli nuclear, you know what I mean, development program, nuclear weapon development program?
I'm very aware that the Israel has a nuclear arsenal.
Anyway, the lady that was there at the Bilderberg did not grant diplomatic immunity or a sanctuary, what I should say, to that individual when he sought sanctuary in Norway from he fled Israel. He was on the run, and Norway would not admit him and provide him a sanctuary from the Israelis. And she was the one that denied that.
She was at that
Bilderberg meeting. You start looking at stuff like that, and you look at the Libya thing where Norway's pulling out totally, August 1st, and it just adds up that Norway was out of line. Get back in line. You're not part of the European Union. You're trying to welch on the deal on Libya, and then you're trying to run a boycott through your labor youth against Israel and things like that. So there was a big confrontation that I see here between Norway and Israel on several levels, see?
Me too.
So as a result, I think there could be some, connection there. We don't have proof of that.
No.
But it's highly likely that NATO is there. And what is interesting, too, though, is when I brought up I went in there and did a study on King Harold, see? And King Harold's, during World War II, he fought with the British against the Nazis, see? And so he's highly thought of in British circles, and he was made a Knight of the Garter. That's one of the highest honors in England. And that's the King of Norway. They're all intertwined here. They're all connected together, see? And that's why I brought up the word synarchy, S-Y-N-A-R-C-H-Y. The secret societies are running all these governments, and they own the central banks. They basically own the central banks. And BIS is in their hip pocket. They're running the whole thing from behind the scenes. The problem right now is that they have suffered some reversals, financial reversals and so forth, because of the derivative market. That's where they lost billions, see? So they had to get out here and get the Federal Reserve to give them illegal credits to save their solvency, to make them liquid again. And that was actually theft from our U.S. Treasury by way of the Fed. Now, when we get back to Oslo, it's very interesting there. And what basically I think they're doing with these security detection units, I believe they're finding people that are 9/11 truthers. I believe they're finding people that are against the banking system. And I believe that they're finding people that question climate change, the global warming, the skeptics. And I believe those are three of the main targets, I think, of these security detection units. They're not operating inside the embassy, so that right there tells you something's wrong. See what I mean?
Absolutely.
They're operating down the street on the third floor of some building down there, and they're told to be very secretive about their gathering of information. There's nothing they are violating. Those units were violating the sovereignty of Norway, and the Norwegian people shouldn't put up with it. They ought to storm the city hall down there and raise some hell, what they should do.
Yeah, it's a mess. I think we're looking at more of a gladiator, too. How far is the spread, George? This control octopus, these cells.
What they've done, they ran this 9/11 inside deal at us, created a 9/11 myth. Out of that came some real, and they attacked Iraq and Afghanistan. Out of those attacks came back to us to visit us some real terrorism. So there is some real terrorists out there. So they're using those real terror attacks against our interests and other allies as a pretense to set up this greater surveillance system through these SDUs and other means, the NSA and all this other stuff, the cyber CyberCom, and then they got 850,000 people in this country with top secret clearances. What's that about? That's only about to curb our freedoms and liberties. If they keep perpetuating it on based on 9/11 myth. If the American public, you know the words that hit my head today. We're going to write an article. It's going to call America for Dummies. America for Dummies. You know how they have these series of books?
Right,
you know,
yes, of course.
Computers for Dummies, this for Dummies. But the American public, unknowingly and unwittingly, have been corralled, cajoled, influenced, educated, mind-washed, brain control, whatever you want to call it, into a state of ignorance about what their leadership is all about. And our leadership that is in control, but the leadership, they're very evil people. They don't care about our founding principles.
What do we say? Not in my name. And further, the Electoral College, we're about to get candidates shoved down our throat. Rick Perry is going to be one of them.
And this is something to notice here, is that they keep pushing Rick Perry from behind the scenes, tended the 2007 Istanbul Bilderberg meeting. So they set him up long ways out. You know, that's 4 years ago.
Absolutely. And when was the mansion burned? We just talked about this off the air earlier today or yesterday.
What's that?
2008. When did the Texas governor's mansion get burned?
Oh, it burned. Yeah, the Texas governor, almost to the day, burned 1 year after he was out there at that Bilderberg meeting.
Could have been a threat to him.
It's coincidence, but you know what I mean? They might mean something. Who knows? But you brought that up. I think that was a good point, Charlotte. It's a warning. You know, we're going to burn you down, burn your house down. You know, if you don't go along with us, who knows?
Yeah,
but he's certainly under their control. So he's under the Bilderberg control, that's for sure.
Right. And the other thing we discovered about the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg of Norway, that he's actually into the same game as Rick Perry, which is private-public partnerships. And if you go to Wikipedia, you're going to find that his first short stint as the Prime Minister, he was only in office less than a year, but he pushed through a tremendous private-public partnerships.
Yes, he did, and that right there is an indication that they're working for these interests that are not really for liberty and freedom interests within the sovereign countries. They're breaking up these countries, and they're taking them over, and they're converting the assets, real assets, into their hands, and they're using government financing to do it.
Yeah, and the people are none the wiser. And
and what they're doing, too, is that they're saying that they're more efficient, and sometimes they are. Temporarily, but in the long run, there's an ownership change that occurs, and that will never go back to the public period.
Legal. More than ownership, it's legal. You cannot repercussion against the private. Now, would you consider
if we let these people own our roads and highways like they've already started doing in this country and all over the world, it's going to be like Middle Ages in Europe. They'll be charging you a fee at every bridge and every road that you travel down. It will totally destroy freedoms and liberties, and it'll cost us a ton to go anywhere. Restrict our freedoms. We can't do this anymore. We've got
freedom
our,
and movement.
All the lines.
Yeah. Well, thank you, George.
Okay. Hey, Richard Reeves out there. He's been doing a lot of work on that toll road. Thank you.
Yeah. It's all
thank you,
Webb,
for all your help, too. Okay. Ted, everybody. Kristen, doing a fabulous job up there.
All right, listeners, we'll see you next week.
Okay,
good night.